Hello and welcome to Cooper Talks, this time an episode for the USA branch and looking at the American Constitution. And the first thing to say is, look at the US Constitution. Go on, take a good look at it. It's a remarkable and inspiring document, but at the end of the day, it is just a document. Yet it's a document that essentially creates a nation. American nationalism is based around the Constitution and the flag. What is there that keeps the people of Texas, the people of New York, the people of Wyoming, the people of Alaska unified and joined together? They don't have a lot in common except the Constitution. This Constitution was a revolutionary document that we tend to take for granted today. It was compact enough that ordinary people, if they were literate, could read and understand it. And they could decide whether or not they were going to vote for it or against it. And that was radical. And that was the idea that they came up with in Philadelphia in 1787. They were going to write down some ideas and put them up for a popular vote. And that document has become venerated across the United States. The one thing all states have in common. The trouble with it is, most students, and I include A-level politics students in this, don't read the Constitution. And if they do read it, they read it blandly, without criticising it or searching for it. It's almost held up as a religious text sometimes in America, and no one questions what it means and why it exists. So, go on, go and read the Constitution, and think about it. What questions would you ask about it? Pause this and come back when you've done it. Okay, you might not have gone and read it, but let's assume you have. What questions did you come up with? Maybe you haven't thought of any. So here's a few to get you started. How democratic is it? Was it a pro-slavery document or an anti-slavery document, or perhaps neutral on the whole issue? Did it really create an indivisible union, as Lincoln claimed when he resisted the idea that states could secede and break away? Why does it say the president has to be 35 years old? Why not 40? Why not 30? Why does it say that a president has to be a natural-born citizen? And to be honest, it doesn't quite say that. There are some interesting exceptions, which if Ted Cruz ever wants to be president, he might be glad of. How did women who didn't have the right to vote get the right to vote? How did you get the right to vote from men who were in charge? How did African-Americans come to get the right to vote? How did 18-year-olds who didn't have the right to vote in 1969, apart from in one state, get the right to vote everywhere by 1972? There's a few questions, and there are many such questions that should arise from a reading of the Constitution. I'm going to hope in this episode to maybe address some of the bigger ones, and maybe get you started in trying to understand the importance and the symbolism of the American Constitution. So let's start with a nice easy one. How revolutionary an idea was it to have a nationwide application process? Now, never before in history had so many people, as the American colonies, gotten a chance to vote on the ground rules on which they and their offspring and their legacy would be governed. Democracy was not an idea that had swept the world in 1787. And this is a fundamentally liberal idea that the people are going to draw up a set of rules and decide whether or not they're going to be ruled by those ideals. They're going to choose their system of government. This is the ultimate liberal idea. Now, only in a very few places before 1787 had democracy existed. Obviously, the Greek city-states, places like Athens and Sparta, for brief periods of time. And they never really got the chance to actually vote for their constitution. It was something that just evolved. It was given to them, effectively, by a man on a hill. No one in England had ever got a vote on the English Constitution, which wasn't even codified, as I'm sure many a scholar and many an A-level student will know. In America, there had been the Articles of Confederation, which were not voted on, and the Declaration of Independence hadn't been voted on. It was just something representatives had chosen to do. The states wrote their own constitutions in 1776 as they broke away from the Union, from the United Kingdom, but none of them were ever put to a special vote. Now, by 1780, Massachusetts enacted a state constitution, which it put up for a vote. And in 1784, New Hampshire did the same. But even these were pretty small local experiments in people choosing their own system of government. The federal constitution took that idea and continentalized it effectively. Never before had so many people been given the opportunity to vote on the rules that would govern them. Now, here's the radical bit. They could have lost. Americans today celebrate Constitution Day on the 17th of September to mark the anniversary of the publishing of the Constitution. But from a legal point of view, not that much actually happened on the 17th of September. All that happened was that a proposal, penned by 39 statesmen, was floated. But that had zero legal significance until people across the country voted that they would accept it. It was just a document, and it was meaningless until the people gave authority to it. Now, the Constitution begins, "We the people do ordain and establish," referring to the 39 men. But when Washington actually proposed this to America, he had no guarantee that it would actually go through. All Washington knew, or any of the other founding fathers, was that when Massachusetts had tried to propose a constitution to the people, it had been voted down before they eventually accepted it. In New Hampshire, three different proposals were floated before they actually succeeded in passing a constitution. On that basis, in the only two places in the world that had proposed a constitution to be confirmed by a special vote of the people, the record was six proposals and only two confirmations, suggesting only a 33.3% chance of success for this brand new federal constitution. Those were not good odds. So, the constitution was proposed, and it could have been voted down. And in fact, in some places, it did get voted down. By the time that George Washington became president in 1789, only 11 of the 13 original states had actually ratified the constitution. Rhode Island and North Carolina had rejected it. In other places, it had only passed by the smallest of margins. In a special convention in New York, it went through by a vote of 30 to 27. If just two people had voted differently, the result would have gone the other way, leaving the USA without New York State, which would have been impossible to imagine. Effectively, the USA would have been split in half between New England and the southern coastal mid-Atlantic states. The USA would have been completely divided and without a major economic centre and port. So that New York vote was crucial for the founding of America. It took a full 9 months after the publication of the Constitution before it went into effect. And the Constitution itself said it would not go into action until at least nine states had voted yes. If it were fewer than nine, it doesn't happen. 9 months after the first Constitution Day on the 17th of September, it still had not been ratified. It was stuck on eight states. Everyone was nervous and on tenterhooks until New Hampshire and then Virginia voted yes, taking it up to 10. But unless New York had said yes, as a practical matter, it was going to be very difficult for the Constitution to work in practice. So the New York vote was probably the most important, although it was New Hampshire and Virginia that ultimately gave it authority. As the states began to take this unprecedented step to ratify the Constitution, eight of the 13 states began to change their rules for who could vote, to allow more people to participate in these special elections. So it's having a radical effect on the very idea of democracy and participation. Property qualifications, meaning you had to own a certain amount of property in order to vote, they were either eliminated or drastically reduced to give more people the opportunity to decide on their constitution. And they changed the rules on who could be elected to these special conventions. Remember, this was not a referendum. Those didn't exist. But a special election, where people had the opportunity to vote for a special representative who would attend a special convention where the only issue was an up-down vote, yes or no, on whether or not to accept the Constitution, and gradually, those states do. The people vote for representatives to choose this constitution. That is what was so radical about the US Constitution. And its impact on democracy was profound, effectively introducing an idea of universal suffrage for men, at any rate, and obviously white men in America, about 100 years before the UK got round to it. Now, while nine were required to create the United States, others could vote no and would be free to go off on their own and do their own thing, which is what Rhode Island and North Carolina attempted for a while, before realising that being on their own was not such a great idea, and they quickly rushed back to join the Union when they realised that was working quite well. That was how the United States was born, with a remarkable act of political inclusion, for the time at least. Now, here's the twist. Yes, for 1787, it was pretty open. But from our point of view in the 21st century, it was pretty narrow. Property qualifications did still exist. Women could not vote. What about slaves? From our point of view, it was a limited form of democracy and a limited form of participation. But from their point of view, it was more expansive than anything that had been written before, and it began to push America in a certain direction. Later amendments continued to develop that story, when black Americans were given the right to vote, and then later women, which helped to expand the definition of we the people of the United States, and helped to expand the idea of democracy and participation that was established in 1787. What about another question? Who were the people? In the very first census, who was being counted? Now, the idea that there would be a census was, again, a radical idea for 1787. The idea that you would count everyone up and base the number of seats in the House of Representatives on the actual population, what we call apportionment. England never did that in the entire 18th century, despite the numbers of people moving around due to the Industrial Revolution. Before the Constitution, only two of the 13 states had even promised that they would have reapportionment based on census data: Pennsylvania and New York. Yet by 1787, neither had actually gone so far as to do anything about it. The Constitution goes further than any of these ideas and actually promises it and says that it will be done every 10 years forever. Every 10 years, they will count everyone up and reapportion the seats in the House of Representatives to reflect the changes in the population. That was the good bit, and seen as a way of perpetuating democracy. But there was a catch. Slavery. How were slaves to be counted? The framers of the Constitution came to the conclusion that they should be counted as 3/5 of a person. Now, you may think that this is a terrible, terrible idea and that they should be counted as 5/5 or a full person. That is the common idea today and what most people would initially assume. The problem is that slaves were not going to be able to vote. If slaves were going to be counted as 5/5 of a person, then the only thing that would change is that the slave masters would have even more voting power than before. So, which would you have preferred? Probably 0/5 of a person, and that is the entire anti-slavery argument at the Philadelphia Convention, that by counting all people and counting slaves as 3/5, the South will be given an artificial boost in representation, not just in the House of Representatives, but in the Electoral College as well for voting for the President, as the number of Electoral College votes a state has is directly tied to the number of congressional seats it has. This creates a major problem. For every decade in perpetuity, the more slaves a state steals, kidnaps, buys, or breeds, the more clout and influence it has in the House of Representatives and in the Electoral College. And that is a vicious principle at the heart of what is otherwise an enlightened and principled apportionment system. This skews the whole political system towards the slaveocracy of the South. Interestingly, no state had counted its slaves that way for its own internal state legislature elections. The 3/5 was therefore going far beyond what the general practice had been. As a result of this bias, For 32 of the first 36 years, the presidency was held by a slave-holding Virginian. Virginia was the big winner in this system. Pennsylvania and Virginia were two states that had the same number of free citizens in those first decades of the United States. But Virginia got a lot more clout because it got to count all of its slaves. With a 2/5 discount, yes, but it still got to count them, while Pennsylvania was getting rid of slavery. In 1800, there was an election between Jefferson of Virginia and Adams of Massachusetts, which was won by Jefferson. The southern states voted for Jefferson, the northern states voted for Adams. What few in America realise even today, and it's sort of skirted over even if you watch the musical Hamilton, is if you take away the 3/5 of the South, Adams and the North win that election. The only reason Jefferson won is because his states had been artificially pumped up in their count by the 3/5 clause. Every Federalist and supporter of Adams at the time knew this and made a big thing about it, in the same way that the Democrats still complain about butterfly ballots and hanging chads in Florida following the 2000 election, and of course Trump's victory when he won but lost by 3 million. So people at the time were aware of this bias, yet it took a civil war to change that system. The ever-increasing dominance of the South, thanks to slavery, meant that, with the exception of John Quincy Adams in 1824, who came second in the Electoral College anyway, all presidents from 1800 until Lincoln's election were either slave owners from the South or pro-slavery Northerners, as this was the only way to get elected. What does all this suggest then? Firstly, the removal of property qualifications suggests the US Constitution was more democratic than many people believe it to be. Yet at the same time, it was also more pro-slavery than many people believe it to be. This begs the question, how can something be both pro-democratic and pro-slavery? This conundrum is epitomised by the 7th president, Andrew Jackson, a man, it's worth bearing in mind, Donald Trump believes he's emulating and sees as his great role model. Andrew Jackson was a populist, a man of the people who created the Democracy Party, which would become the Democrats. He is anti-wealthy, but at the same time is very pro-slavery. The Constitution created a world that privileged people like Andrew Jackson, who saw no distinction between being anti-wealthy, ordinary working people, yet he himself was a slave-owning aristocrat of quite wealthy means. This raises a question. Why did the North give so much away to the South? One option might have been to forget the South and for the North to go it alone. Okay, basically create two countries, the whole idea that the Confederates during the Civil War came up with. The problem was the idea of national security and fear of tyranny. The idea was that a more perfect union was required to secure peace and protection against foreign foes. If North and South were not united, then foreign regimes like Britain or France could play them off against each other, as it happened during the Civil War. This would have led to the North and South competing for who would control the West, which had yet to be colonised, and both sides wanted control over the western part of the United States landmass. So there was an understanding on that. Also, some of the key figures of the period, including George Washington, the symbol of America, were Virginians, and the North couldn't afford to lose them. Having fought a war together to stay united against the British, they wanted to stay together if they could. This meant the South needed some accommodation, which explains the problem of the Electoral College. If there had been a direct election of the president based on one person, one vote, and with no 3/5, then the South would lose all presidential elections and effectively be excluded. If you just count free persons and have no 3/5 for slaves, then the South will be an early and likely permanent minority in the House of Representatives. The South is worried about that. It knows the risk. So the North had to make some accommodation to secure the support of the South in ratifying the Constitution. Otherwise, the Constitution doesn't come into existence. The problem was that the North did not realise what a big deal the Three-Fifths Clause was going to be. Instead, the North was focused on the issue of apportionment and taxation. Under the Articles of Confederation, every state got one vote in the Congress, whether it was a big or small state, and there was no election of a president because there was no president. The Northerners were therefore not worried about how apportionment or presidential elections would occur, as they were far more focused on taxation and getting the South to pay their fair share of taxes. The North compromised on three-fifths as a way of imposing higher taxation on the South, but they didn't seem to realise how significant the political effect would be, which only became clear in later decades. It's also important to remember that slavery was a way of life in the South, and most of the economy in the South was based on slavery. So it would be no easy thing to change it immediately, without huge economic desolation in the South, again, basically earning the enmity of the South. The Northerners, as practical, rational, liberal men, did not want to cause economic ruin. Perhaps the framers could have introduced a gradual phasing out of slavery, as it occurred in Pennsylvania and would occur in New York, to give time to eliminate slavery by giving time for the economy to switch focus, and so slave owners would not lose out. Such a thing may have worked, as many slave owners in the 18th century, like Washington and Jefferson, saw that it was wrong, but did not want to destroy their own livelihood and family legacy by eliminating slavery in one go. It's a bit like a smoker who knows it's wrong, but they wouldn't want an immediate ban. But a ban in the future that may save their children or grandchildren might be acceptable. By failing to do this, and with the growing political bias to the South, slavery actually increases and became far more ingrained in Southern society and became defended as a positive virtue, which ultimately resulted in civil war, segregation and the Jim Crow laws, and the ongoing racial tensions in America today. So what about the power to end the slave trade? Remember, the word slavery is never actually used in the Constitution because the framers were too embarrassed and ashamed to state it. But the Three-Fifths Clause is just one example of the Constitution being pro-slavery in spite of this. In addition, the Constitution has the 1808 provision, which is also pro-slavery by implication. This states that 20 years after the ratification of the Constitution, Congress would have the power to end the importation of slaves. Note, this is not an end to slavery in the USA, but only the importation from outside the USA, meaning no more new slaves, no more slave kidnapping, no more slave ships or anything else. Effectively, this would have been a phased-in solution. No ban on the importation until 20 years had passed, suggesting it could also have been done with the Three-Fifths Clause and demonstrating the framers' concern over the nature of the slave trade. It is also worth bearing in mind that most slaves were male and most died after a few years. So the ban on the importation of slaves would effectively have led to the decline in slavery in the USA. So maybe, of course, we can think of this as an attempt to phase out slavery. Of course, the 1808 provision only says that Congress may introduce a ban in 1808. It does not say it must be passed, and such a ban could only be passed by a majority in both chambers and signed by the president, both of which are likely to be dominated by the slaveocracy, thanks to the Three-Fifths Clause that gave the South a huge boost. The other problem was the discovery of cotton and the cultivation of the Deep South, which promoted slavery in the 1800s and turned out to be one of the few places on earth where slaves not only survived but endured, allowing owners to breed slaves without the need to import new ones from outside the USA. Another pro-slavery clause in the Constitution relates to the recapture of slaves who run away from one state to another. The Constitution clearly states that even if a slave makes it to a free state, that free state must send the slave back to the state they had fled from. This becomes a real bone of contention in the 1850s, as free states increasingly resent having to pay slave catchers and send black people accused of being slaves back to slavery in the South. It also became an issue as free black men and women who had been born free or given freedom by their owner were effectively kidnapped and sent to the South, as is recorded in 12 Years a Slave. This happened because the pro-slavery Congress, thanks to those extra votes due to the three-fifths clause, set up commissioners to decide whether or not a captured person was really a free man or a captured slave. These commissioners were paid $10 per slave they sent to the South, and only $5 if they ruled that the person was a free man or woman and let them go free. So the commissioners were in effect bribed to send free men and women to the slave state. This was further upheld by the Supreme Court, which was a pro-slavery court, largely appointed by slave-owning presidents who'd been elected thanks to the three-fifths clause, which goes to show that the system of checks and balances was certainly not infallible, and that the three-fifths clause wasn't just a little embarrassment, but a fundamental flaw with the Constitution. Now, what about modern issues linked to this? What about affirmative action? Affirmative action is a process of what we might call positive discrimination, which is attempting to redress past wrongs by giving an advantage to African Americans in college admissions and employment today. There are good constitutional arguments in favour of it and equally good constitutional arguments against it, though the full range of this will be done by your teachers when you deal with the Supreme Court and race relations rather than looking at the Constitution. In debating the constitutional merits of the arguments for and against affirmative action, the history of the USA needs to be remembered. The Constitution itself was not colourblind and was not race neutral. It was clearly a pro-slavery document. For some, that justifies the arguments for some sort of rectification or remediation or affirmative action to undo the legacy of the past. For other people, the argument is that what was wrong in the past was that the Constitution was uneven and modern America should simply stop discriminating on the basis of race, and that is the way to rectify the flaws in the Constitution. Now, both of these are reasonable positions and were recently echoed in the Supreme Court in the last decade. John Paul Stevens and John Roberts argued these points of view respectively. However, there is the historical consideration to be made, which is that the Constitution did make America a profoundly unequal society. The Constitution was pro-slavery. The Electoral College was pro-slavery. And for some people, that history is a justification for affirmative action. For others, like Chief Justice John Roberts, they see all the history, but they see affirmative action, or the idea of affirmative action as a cure, itself creates a problem of an unequal society based on race. So both are arguing similar ideological positions, but from very different perspectives. So let's ask ourselves, why does America have the Electoral College? And let's face it, after Trump's election, where he lost by 3 million votes, but won the Electoral College, a lot of people have been asking this question. As with so much in the US Constitution, the Electoral College was created directly as a result of slavery. Let's go back to the Philadelphia Convention. We've got our 39 delegates sat around, and one man called James Wilson, a framer from the state of Pennsylvania, he stands up and he suggests at this convention that the president should be elected by direct national popular vote. That's the simple, obvious solution. James Madison gets up in response and argues that while in principle, that would be the right thing to do. It's great. Lovely idea, James Wilson. Here's the problem. The maths for the South just don't add up. As the South didn't let its people in the form of slaves vote, there is no way a Southerner would have been able to win the presidency. And that would prevent the South from adopting the Constitution. So Madison says, your idea is great, but it won't work in the South. He goes on to argue that if there was some sort of electoral college that directly mirrored the House of Representatives. Then the South would get credit for their slaves without having to let them vote. And the South would accept the Constitution. While there are many arguments for and against the Electoral College today, it is important to remember that it only exists as a means of appeasing slave owners. Now, we've looked at the House there with the 3/5 and the Electoral College. How democratic is the Senate? How bad is it really that big states get equal representation with small states in the Senate? That California has 38 million people ends up with the same number of votes in the Senate as Wyoming with 330,000 people. Clearly, in the modern world, this is unfair and undemocratic. Normally, California's population would give them a Senate representation equal to about 42 other senators from the 21 smallest population states. This just doesn't seem to be fair. So, can equal representation in the Senate be justified? In one sense, it is at least no worse than the Articles of Confederation had been, which had state equality, where every state got one vote, and that was the only principle that existed before the House of Representatives was drawn up. At least under the Constitution, the bias of the Articles of Confederation is mitigated a bit by the House and the population basis for the presidential elections. The other thing to think about is how much difference does it really make? The small states do not, in fact, have that much in common with each other. Nor do the big states. Think about it. California and Texas, or Wyoming and Maine? Therefore, it tends to cancel each other out. Okay, California is a big state, it goes Democrat, but Texas is a Republican state. It's not got that many fewer electoral college votes. Maine tends towards being Democrat. It's got 4 electoral college votes. On the other hand, you've got Wyoming, 3 electoral college votes. That's as Republican as you can get. It's a balance. Some states have a bit of an advantage and some states have a bit of a disadvantage. Because regional concerns tend to trump size concerns, the nature of the system in America doesn't lead to a systemic skewing in one type or the other, in the way that in England, until 1832, cities and urban areas were drastically underrepresented while rural areas were massively overrepresented, which resulted in predictable systematic skews towards rural areas and farmers against urban areas, businesses and industrial output. The random effects of the malapportionment of the Senate do not result in anything like those systemic skews, though this was more by luck than by design. Of course, the third point is that if it is undemocratic, it can now be changed through the amendment process. There may be some issues with this. Firstly, why would the small states want to change a system that benefits them? As an instant amendment, probably not. But with population shifts and flow across the states, perhaps an appeal to the future might work. Nevada, Colorado and Arizona have all seen recent growth in populations, while Ohio and Pennsylvania have seen their populations decrease. People might live in small population states now, but they might find they live in larger states in the future, or their children will, or perhaps their grandchildren will be Californians, and therefore it's a system that Americans really want to leave for future. And therefore, is it a system that Americans really want to leave for the future generations? Perhaps a phased proportional system for the Senate over a period of 20 or 30 years would be one solution that could be accepted by most states. After all, while for some the current system is in their interests, most Americans also know and feel that the system is wrong and should be changed, which is the framers knew slavery was wrong, but they wanted to keep it. Here's another little teaser. Does Article 5 prohibit the making of an amendment to change the number of senators? Okay, Article 5 says that if the people want to change the rule about having 2 senators per state, then they basically have to get the consent of every state to make that change. This would make the answer yes, but only if all 50 states agree to it, which means it's highly unlikely. So this, in order to change that, in order to have more than 2 senators per state, all 50 states would have to agree to it, far beyond the requirements for any other amendment. However, There have been some legal proposals which might allow a determined supermajority to get around it. So you can't change the two senators per state rule because it's entrenched in the Article 5 of the Constitution, but you could perhaps pass an amendment changing the rule in Article 5. Once that has been changed, then you could change the two senators per state rule. Could this be done at the same time, with one effectively passed a second before the other? Legally, it can be done, and reduces the difficulty down to the regular difficulty of passing an amendment. So it could become more flexible. Alternatively, Article 5 says you cannot change the apportionment of the Senate without all states agreeing, but could you instead change the powers of the Senate? This would require a normal amendment, creating a new body which would have all the powers that the current Senate has. So as far as Article 5 is concerned, everything is still fine, as there's been a change to the no change to the apportionment of the Senate, but a new, more proportional third chamber has taken its place. While both of these ideas would be constitutional, 13 small states would still have the power to block any of these amendments. So while the situation is made easier, it would still be almost impossible to agree to it. But that goes back to the issue of why would small states want to change the system? So what is it about the Constitution that has allowed it to withstand the various crises it has been subject to? What is it that makes the US Constitution work? You might feel that the Constitution has survived because of the amendment process, or because it can be seen as a living document that evolves under interpretations through the Supreme Court. That is, it survives due to separation of powers, checks and balances, the courts and federalism. However, we should remember that the Constitution is just a piece of paper. A noble piece of paper, yes, but just a piece of paper. And that is what the and it is what the actors of the day make of it that make it what it is. On that basis, it is the American people and the American landmass that have allowed the Constitution to survive. Remember, it was never clear or inevitable that America was going to make it as a nation. They'd only just won the War of Independence, and in 1812, the British burnt Washington, D.C. to the ground. Then there was the Civil War, where the USA nearly destroyed itself. Checks and balances, separation of powers, the judicial system and federalism are all important. But it means nothing if the American people do not understand all this and are educated in it and, crucially, take pride in it. The American landmass has also played a key role in the survival of the Constitution. This is mainly because, for most of its history, the USA has been removed from the dangers of the rest of the world. That is why it was so essential that North and South united, that the West was conquered by the USA and not left to others, and why the USA tried for so long to stay out of international affairs. Had North and South started to fight against each other, each would have developed a military to fight each other, and then each would need a military figure to head the army. Then the army would get bigger, then there'd be an arms race, and finally, tyranny. And that's the thing the framers and American people were most afraid of and have been ever since. When the framers wrote the Constitution, they looked around and they saw there were only two countries that were relatively free from tyranny, the UK and Switzerland. Why were the Swiss free? The Swiss don't have a common language, they don't have a common religion or a common identity. Instead, they have the Alps. The Alps make it very difficult to conquer or attack the land trapped by the Alps. And that is why the Swiss have been able to remain largely free with a small army of its own. What makes the UK free? It's an island. When Scotland and England were separate, they would have large armies and fight, and France would play them off against each other. Once England and Scotland created a union, then a big army was no longer necessary. A navy, yes, but navies are not threatening to domestic liberty in the way that standing armies are. Remember, neither Switzerland nor the UK were successfully attacked by the Nazis, even in World War II. So why has the US Constitution survived? Because the framers were foresighted enough to create their own more perfect union, like Scotland and England. And there would be a great big ocean keeping the USA safe from the monarchs and tyrants living in the old world. This also helps to explain the willingness to negotiate the Louisiana Purchase and the enthusiasm for recognizing new republics as they broke away from Spain and the creation of the Monroe Doctrine. By using the ocean as a barrier, there would be no need for a large standing army in the USA during peace times, so the country could be defended by a simple militia with their own guns. For much of American history, there's been no significant standing army in peacetime. Not until after World War II did that happen. The result of all this was that the USA did not have to spend a lot of money on their own army, which allowed the economy to grow and to flourish. The army was not there to threaten domestic liberty. The people could be free. Only once in American history, between the end of the Revolutionary War and 9/11, did foreigners enter the USA and draw blood on the continental United States, and that was in 1812. In combination with the growing fear of a terror attack, there has been a simultaneous rise in fear and terror along the Mexican border, and the belief that armies of Mexicans and other Hispanics are invading and attacking continental America. It is these new threats to American security and the growing fear of a foreign attack on the American heartlands that is fueling much of the constitutional angst and fear of big government that is propelling the libertarian movement, that created the Tea Party movement, which has led to the Freedom Caucus playing such a significant role in American politics today. As the current generation of Americans has to deal with these new, real or perceived threats, and the Constitution once again comes under serious strain. So what about people getting the right to vote? How did they get the right to vote? Well, in 1968, in 48 out of 50 states, 21 had been set as the voting age. 4 years later, it is 18 everywhere. How and why does this massive change occur? The answer was Vietnam. The growing feeling in the late 1960s was, if you're old enough to fight, you're old enough to vote. If you're old enough to be drafted and to be sent to Vietnam and be shot at and maybe die, then you're old enough to vote on whether or not the USA should have been taken into that war in the first place. This change in age is part of the evolving link between political responsibilities, like fighting, and political rights, like voting. The 26th Amendment was at least the fourth occasion where the American enfranchisement was expanded, and they were all driven by one key factor: war. At the founding, people who had previously been excluded due to property qualifications got the right to vote. This was mainly because when Pennsylvania drew up its voting qualifications, most of its militiamen who had fought with George Washington wouldn't have had the right to vote, because they didn't own any enough land or property. Whereas most of the wealthy who'd sided with King George would have been able to vote. This removal of the property qualification therefore came as a reward for loyalty and service to the country. 11 years later in the Constitutional Convention, Benjamin Franklin emphasized this point, that there were no property qualifications for serving the country in the war, and therefore there should be no property qualifications for voting on how that country should be run. Move forward to 1865. Why do black men get the right to vote before white women, and why then? It's the Civil War. Black Americans took up arms and fought for the Union, 100,000 or so flocking to the Union Army and making up 20% of the forces, this at a time when in the northern states they made up barely about 6% of the population. They were, in essence, the margin of victory in Civil War. Without those black troops, the Union would have lost, probably. Therefore, black American men were not given the right to vote, but earned it for themselves by fighting for the Union. Why did women get the right to vote? In large part, as they did around the world, because of World War I. Women were part of the great fight, on the home front, stoking the economy. As a result, Woodrow Wilson proposed woman suffrage explicitly as a wartime measure. Wilson also wanted to ensure that after the war, America would be the moral leader of the world, which would need some credibility. This necessitated giving women the right to vote, especially when Germany and Austria had begun to give some of their women the right to vote in 1919. Therefore, the amendments which have expanded the franchise have come as a result of war. suggesting perhaps that war really is a great engine for democracy. You can debate that for your own interest. So how constitutional has the recent behaviour of Congress been? All the divisions, the backbiting, the fighting, the refusing to hold votes and the partisan opposition. Under Article 1, Section 5 of the Constitution, each House gets to make its own rules for its own proceedings. Therefore, constitutionally, what rules take place for what votes and for what votes are up to each chamber. So issues like the idea of the filibuster used in the Senate, or who chairs which committees, or how assignments are allocated, or quorum votes, are perfectly constitutional, even if today they're morally questionable. What was the role then of the Federals and the Anti-Federals in the founding of the Constitution? When the Constitution was written as a federal document, it resulted in a large national conversation and conflagration about the nature of the new country. While the winners are praised and lauded as the founding fathers, there were, it is important to remember, a number of losers who opposed the idea of a federal union, many of whom were heroes of the war and prominent citizens, such as Patrick Henry and James Monroe, who would later become the fifth president. In this sense, the creation of the Constitution was clearly different from the Declaration of Independence. Those who opposed the Declaration or sided with the British basically had to leave America and certainly never held prominent office in the States again. With the Constitution, the view was that they were all brothers in arms, and it was reasonable to have disagreements and to continue to respect each other. This became one of the key aspects of the Constitution, that it was a genuine conversation about the way the United States would be governed, with people being free to oppose it, but still go on to be successful once it was implemented. With the winners and losers accepting the final verdict of the American people, which creates the very idea of compromise and consensus that permeated so much of American politics until today. In fact, one crucial element of the anti-federals was that they saw the flaws of the Constitution and pointed out that it needed a Bill of Rights and some amendments to make it work. In order to secure the votes, like those two crucial votes in New York, the pro-federals promised to work with the anti-federals to pass the required amendments if the Constitution was ratified. Without that national dialogue, those rights and liberties may never have become established within the Constitution, and it's a sign of compromise, consensus, and bipartisan cooperation that made the American Constitution work. And it's only in this current era that we really see the ending of that compromise and the failings within the Constitution. There's an important lesson from 1787 about the role of the dissenting tradition in America and the fact that the American political system is predicated on consensus, not on parliamentary-style adversarial politics. So as a last question, just to think about here, why are the Conservatives on the Supreme Court not always united over how to interpret the Constitution? The key thing to remember here is that there are different types of Conservatives. Roberts and Alito are both quite different Conservatives from Clarence Thomas, early signs of Neil Gorsuch, and who knows if Kavanaugh actually ends up getting onto the court, but they're certainly different from Kennedy. So they're all different, and they've got competing views and competing ideas. Back in the day, Scalia and Thomas would say that interpretations should be based on the original intent and text of the Constitution. Roberts and Alito, well, they tend to look more at precedent and a narrow role for the court, which are different sensibilities. Now, of course, originalism in the Scalia mould and looking at the Constitution in its original meaning is not in itself an inherently conservative idea. John Paul Stevens, former liberal justice, countered loads of Scalia-type arguments and Thomas opinions with his own interpretation of the original meaning of the Constitution. Famously, back in the sort of 50s era, Justice Hugo Black, one of the most liberal justices for many years, appointed by FDR and a driving force on the Warren Court, he also based his justifications and opinions on the original intent and a strict constructionist approach of the Constitution. The truth of this matter is that originalism and strict constructionism are just judicial justifications for achieving what you want on the court. Basically, if you look hard enough, you can justify anything by the original intent of the founding fathers because there's so many of them. But Roberts has a different view of the role of the court from what Scalia and Thomas and even traditional liberals on the court have. Scalia and Thomas and Gorsuch look to the past, but Roberts looks to the future. And this returns us to the original point. The Constitution, for all its flaws and all its greatness, is just a document. It's just a piece of paper. It can be viewed and interpreted in many different ways, through strict or loose constructions, originalism or precedent, as a living or as a dead constitution. Each interpretation can be viewed as supporting conservative points of view, or as liberal points of view, or even neutral national interest points of view. The Constitution set up a revolutionary and principled system of republican-style democracy that offered freedom and rights protections to its citizens. Yet in order to create this more perfect union, the framers included severely unfair and undemocratic principles in a tremendously pro-slavery document. The Constitution has enlightened and principled ideals, but also undemocratic and regressive aspects. The framers created a document that they wanted to work in creating a new nation, and from the earliest days accepted it was not a perfect document and was flawed. The problems of America today are not the result of the Constitution, but, as they have always been, the problems of the current political actors who seek to venerate the Constitution and claim precedence in order to achieve their own ends. Now that, in a nutshell, is American politics. I hope that's been useful and given you some food for thought on the US Constitution. I'll return again with maybe some slightly shorter, but also in-depth looks at different aspects of American politics. I should also say, just in finishing off, that if you'd like to post any comments on feedback, or if there's any topics you would like me to consider or address on any aspects of politics, mostly focused on A-level courses, then please drop me a line in the comments boxes and I'll see what I can do about those in the near future. Thank you very much for listening, and hope to speak to you again at some point soon.